So let's get going. We're starting to look at the program's code. We loaded the program into IDA Pro, and it's showing us a code excerpt. And I mentioned to you that when you're looking at a block of code, you're not quite sure where to begin your analysis. Start focusing on the call statements, because a call is a way of invoking a block of code that somehow the programmer decided logically belongs together. Usually, that code implements some functionality that is an action, such as printing a message to the screen, or reading a file, or sending network traffic. The programmer, of course, used some meaningful names to call his functions, like print to screen or save to file. But that information is typically stripped away from us. Now, what IDA Pro does is it needs to give it some name, so it will name it by prefixing it with a sub, S-U-B. Sub means it's a subroutine, which is a synonym for function. It's function, subroutine, procedure. I'm going to use those terms interchangeably. So this is some kind of a function, a subroutine. We don't know what it was called, but we do know that it resides at the relative address 401.2c6. So we don't know what it does, we don't know what it was called, but we're going to call it sub401.2c6. If we figure out what it is and what it does, we have the option of renaming it in IDA Pro to make it easier to read the code. The reason I'm showing this particular block of code to you is because I think it's interesting to see the same function called over and over and over and over again. A little bit weird, a little bit unusual. A lot of these functions accept parameters. For example, if you have a function that prints a message to the screen, one of its parameters will probably be the message that you want it to print. If you have a function that opens a file, one of the parameters to the function might be the name of the file to open. In assembly, the most common ways of passing parameters to functions is to use the push instruction. So when you have an instruction push before a call, in most cases it is because some information, some parameter is being passed to the function. In this case, we're pushing data that resides at some memory location. What IDA Pro is doing for us is it's automatically inserting comments, and IDA Pro noticed that what's being pushed here is actually an ASCII string, in this case, NHL*PWF. This parameter is being pushed. Where is it being pushed? There's a special data structure called the stack that the program uses to store data that it is actively using right now. And in most cases, parameters are pushed to the stack before a function is invoked. And when the function is executing, it'll know to grab those parameters from the stack. So we pushed an ASCII string to the stack, NHL*PWF. Or strictly speaking, we pushed to the stack the address where this function resides. And then we called that function. And look, the same function is being called here over and over again, but with different parameters. NHL*PWF, then in this case, WTWGR, the same function is called every time it's being invoked with a slightly different parameter. Well, they're all different, but what's in common? They're all cryptic looking. They all look like gibberish. Might they all be encrypted or obfuscated? I'm showing this to you because this is a pattern of that many programs use to decode protected strings. In many cases, the author of the program concealed some sensitive strings within the executable. They're embedded within the executable, but he does not want you to see them or to recognize them when you run it through strings or through bin text. So, what he did is he obfuscated the strings, or maybe encrypted them. But before the program uses those strings, it needs to decode them to their original values. And this is, in many cases, how it's going to do it. You're going to see a block of code like this, and it's somewhere in the beginning of the program's execution, and it's going to call the same decryption or deobfuscation function over and over again for every possible string that was encoded in the executable. That's the pattern that I think is happening here. So even though we don't know exactly what the function does, this pattern suggests that it might be decoding these strings. Now in IDA Pro, you can actually look at that function to see what it does. It's easy. Double-click on it, and it's going to take you to the code of that function, and you can start examining its assembly instructions. Now, I don't want to show you that code just now, because we're not there yet. I don't really want to take the time to go through that code very carefully. But I did look at that code, and I was able to confirm that indeed it is a deobfuscation function. What this function did is it iterated through the string one character at a time, and it used an algorithm to derive the original value from that string. Once you understand this algorithm, you could decode all of these strings manually. But that's going to be a big waste of time, probably very slow. So the technique is typically, if you can understand the decryption or the deobfuscation algorithm, you want to typically implement it as a program using your favorite programming language or your favorite scripting language. What I hear is I implemented it in Perl. So Perl is the scripting language that I use. Yes, it's not very pretty to look at. Yes, it's got a ton of punctuation everywhere. But what this script does is it's got a loop, and it steps through the string one character at a time backwards, because that's what the program's algorithm does. And it uses this caret. That's the XOR operator. XOR is a Boolean operand that's oftentimes used for encryption or obfuscation. And what it does is the following. It steps through through the string one character at a time, starting from the end of the string, and for every character that it finds, it XORs the ordinal value of that character with the position of that character from the right side of the string. True. A mouthful to say, it ultimately doesn't matter. As long as you can understand the algorithm, you can implement a script like this. And now, you can just decrypt all those strings, or deobfuscate them. Why am I using the terms decryption and deobfuscation, and I differentiate between the two? In my mind, encryption is something that is hard to understand, hard to reverse, something that typically needs a key or a password. In this case, there is no key. It's just if you know how to manipulate those characters, you'll be able to derive the original value. So this is really obfuscation. Now, in a program like that, there are a lot of strings that look like they might be encrypted. Which one of them should you decrypt? Which ones should you deobfuscate? Well, try all of them. That's really the technique that works well for me. So what I did is I used the strings command to extract all possible strings, and then I piped them into the script that I created. Now that produced a lot of gibberish, because not every string is meant to be deobfuscated using my algorithm. But if you pipe this into another instance of strings, you will find a few that look like they might be ASCII English-like strings. And here's what I pulled out. So on the right side are the decoded strings that I found in the executable. On the left side are their obfuscated versions. And I highlighted in yellow those that we have already observed behaviorally. How did the program know which nickname to use when connecting to the IRC channel? Well, it's hard-coded in one of these protected strings, Mikey. We've got the channel name. We've got the server name hard-coded as well. You can also see that there are some protected strings within this executable that we have not observed behaviorally. This shows you the limitation of relying purely on behavioral analysis. There's going to be some things that you probably will not observe. For example, you've got a string like this, aggressive, in all capital letters. I don't know what it does, but it sounds really scary. I'd like to find out. How would you do that? Well, you can find where the string like this is embedded in the code, and IDA Pro will usually be able to tell you which code makes use of this string. And now you can examine that code and see what it does. That's how, in many cases, you can begin your analysis with strings. You find interesting strings, whether they're obfuscated or not, and then you find the code that uses them, and then you try to understand what that code does. Once you've understood what a function does, in IDA Pro, you select that function and you press N. It'll bring up this box that allows you to rename. You can assign a name to that function. So it used to have this meaningless name of sub4012c6. Click on it, select N, and I can name it like decode stir or deobfuscate stir or whatever. So as you go through your analysis, as you understand what functions do, you can rename them. So that when you look at this block of code again, it's easier for you to understand what's happening there. So how did I figure out that the algorithm is really this stepping through the string one character at a time and using XOR? Well, I purposefully skipped over that part, because what I did there is I spent a few hours, because I'm not a very good assembly expert, so I spent a few hours looking at that assembly code, and I could see instructions for looping through the string, extracting each byte, using XOR to manipulate it. So I looked at that code, and I understood its meaning, and I wrote it down on a piece of paper, and then I implemented it using a Perl script. I'm going to show you how to do that on day 3 of the class, actually. I'm going to show you assembly code, and we're going to go through it, and we're going to derive similar meaning from the assembly instructions. Right now, though, it's not the best use of our time, so that's why I purposefully skipped over it. But in general, I find code analysis to be pretty time-consuming. Maybe it's because my strength is not in my ability to understand the program assembly, so it ends up being time-consuming to me. That's all right. As long as you understand where your strengths are and your weaknesses are, you end up adjusting this approach to follow the path that's the easiest for you. And for me, the easiest is to do as much as I can behaviorally, and then do some selective code analysis where I really have to. Now, what I would like to spend our time on in this particular example, because I think there's good learning to be done, is to try to understand what's within that file gus.ini. Because we're examining an executable, our goal is to understand its capabilities. We're not going to have time to go all the way to understand its capabilities, but we have this file. It's protected. And the weird thing about this file is that it is protected using a different algorithm, not the one that I just described. So what's there? How do we figure out what's there? In modern malware, it is not uncommon to see a malicious executable protecting its strings, protecting its configuration files, protecting its DLLs. They might be encrypted. How do you decrypt them? In this case, we know that the gus.ini file is read by this program from the file system. How do we know that? We saw that in Process Monitor earlier. But the file is encrypted. Well, in another example, you might have seen something very similar, but maybe there, instead of reading the file locally, maybe it was downloading the file from the web. That file might have been encrypted as well. How do you get its values? Well, the way you approach this, there are several ways in which you could approach this. One way that Tim brought up is maybe to try to do some memory forensics to see if that file is loaded in clear text anywhere in memory. That's a valid approach, not the one that I want to take now, because instead I want to show you how to make use of a debugger to do things like this. And we're going to use a debugger because it allows us to step through the code very slowly and really understand what it does. That's really the purpose of the debugger. The debugger that we're going to use in this course, because I like it, because it's powerful, is called OliDebug. OliDebug. OliDebug is nice because it runs on Windows, it's free, it's very powerful and pretty mature, and also it was written specifically for the purpose of analyzing executables for Windows for which you don't have source code. That's exactly what we need a debugger for. So we're going to use it. Now, IDA Pro actually has a debugger built into it. So if you don't like OliDebug, you might be fine just sticking with IDA Pro. It's got what you need. Similarly, OliDebug has a pretty good disassembler built into it. So, you know, if you don't like IDA Pro, you're fine using OliDebug exclusively because it will have a disassembler in it. But I use IDA Pro because I really love the way it disassembles things. And I end up doing most of my debugging in OliDebug because I really like the way it allows me to step through executables and because of the plugins that are available for OliDebug that I've come to rely on. But you don't have to do that. What can you do with a debugger? Well, there are a few shortcuts on this slide. You don't need to remember them, but this is something that you might refer to throughout the course. The kinds of things that you do with a debugger is you step through the code one instruction at a time. Because if you're looking at a block of code that's hard to understand, the way you do understand it is that you execute one instruction, and then OliDebug or any other debugger would allow you to see how did this instruction change the state of the world? How did it operate on the memory? How did it change its registers? How did it write something to the file system? And once you understand that little bit that the program did with a single instruction, then you execute another instruction, and you pause, and you observe what happened now. That really helps you understand even the most esoteric block of code. Realistically, though, you will never have time to step through every single instruction of a program. It's frankly just impossible. So debuggers allow you to set breakpoints. And a breakpoint is a condition that will allow a debugger to execute the program very fast, normally, But as soon as that condition occurs, all a debug is going to pause and give you control. And in many cases, those conditions are going to be very simple, like pause as soon as you reach this particular instruction. So execute the program normally, but as soon as you reach this particular instruction, pause, give me control, and allow me to look around and allow me to stop to start stepping through the program. And OliDebug will not only allow you to step through the instructions, but it will also allow you to look at memory, even modify memory, modify instructions, look at registers. You have a lot of visibility into what the program does. You're going to experiment with OliDebug this afternoon if you have not already done that before coming to the class. You're going to see that its screen is pretty busy. There's a lot going on that screen. The good news is that if there's a particular piece of information that you're looking for, chances are it's somewhere on the screen. Sometimes it's hard to know where to look, though, because the screen is very busy. It divides its screen into several regions, and where you end up spending the most time probably is what it calls the CPU region. This is the disassembler. The CPU view that OliDebug gives you is split into several regions, and one of those regions is going to be the disassembler. This is the stuff that's also built into IDA Pro. This is the disassembled block of code that you're looking at. And you can step through this one instruction at a time. Or, if you want to, you can tell OliDebug, you know what, execute all of these instructions in one step, and then pause. You have the same kind of information available here that would be available for you in IDA Pro. Yes. So you bring up syntax. There are several conventions that people use to represent assembly instructions. We're following in this course the Intel convention. Another one that you bring up is AT&T. I don't know if OliDebug supports AT&T. IDA probably does. Frankly, I actually try to, because I'm so used to Intel syntax, I end up forcing all my tools to use Intel. Is AT&T the syntax that you're used to? Oh. Most malware analysts end up using the Intel syntax, and all the examples that you'll see out there on Microsoft Windows will be Intel syntax. That's what Microsoft tools use, so that's probably, if you're going to get used to one syntax, Intel is the one to get used to, because everything that you're going to see out there for Windows is going to be using this Intel syntax. Yeah. So, what do we see here? Well, we've got assembly instructions, just like in IDA Pro. Now, IDA Pro, I prefer the way IDA Pro lays things out for me, the way it color codes things, even though you can customize that view in OliDebug as well. But I like IDA Pro's way of representing things. That's why when I just need to look at the code, I prefer to do that in IDA Pro. But if I have to, I can use OliDebug as well. You see all the information is here. The instructions themselves, you've got the locations where the instructions are located. I'm not crazy about everything being in capital letters, because I feel like somebody's screaming at me when it's all caps, but that's all right. At least it's all visible and easy to read. What you see in the second column here on the left side is the opcodes that represent the assembly instructions that you're looking at. Because what the CPU sees is binary represented as hex here. So this is, in the second column, is what the CPU can understand. But most mortal human beings, when they look at these assembly instructions in hex, can't figure out what's here. Although I did see a few people who can look at this and kind of tell what's going on, which is scary to me. But most of us use a disassembler. What a disassembler does is it looks at this hex, and it shows you something that's a bit easier to read. That's the job of the disassembler, to move us from the second column to the third column. So our task at hand is to figure out what gus.ini is about, or specifically what's within that file. Where do we begin? Well, we begin with what we know. And what we know about this particular file is that it is read from the file system by the program. So what we can do is we can look through the program's code for any kind of API calls, any kind of system calls that can read a file from the file system, and we can begin our analysis there. If our behavioral analysis showed us that this file was read from a web server, we would look at a different set of API calls that allow the program to read things over the internet. And I'm actually going to spend a lot of time on day 3 showing you those common API calls and the way they're used. In this case, though, we're looking for file system level API calls, like the one that I'm showing you on this slide here. It's a call to a function called fopen. Fopen is a system call to a Windows DLL that knows how to open a local file. Now, fopen needs to know two things to open a file. It needs to know the path of that file or its name. It also needs to know how you want to open the file, for writing or for reading. An example on this slide, you see two parameters pushed to the stack before the call. That's because those are the two values that the call requires, the path and the mode. How do I know this? Well, it's all out there in Google, and Microsoft API calls are pretty well documented by Microsoft. You can read that in the documentation. Otherwise, if you could not find any documentation, then you can kind of tell as you step through the program, you would observe how the program uses this data. This parameter is the letter R. R tells fopen to open a file for reading. So as I'm looking through this code, I'm looking for calls to fopen that could open a file for reading. This is the one, the only one that I could locate. So I can begin my analysis from here. What I can do in a debugger is I can set a breakpoint on this fopen, execute my malicious program, and as soon as it pauses, I will know that it's trying to open some file for reading, and I can begin my analysis from that point on. I also don't have to execute the program. I can just look at this code to try to figure out what it does. That's called static analysis. When people say that they do static analysis, they mean they just look at the code in a disassembler without running it, without debugging it. If you debug it, people call it dynamic analysis sometimes. Well, look, we located fopen. The theory is that probably this is the call that opens gust.ini. What happens next? Well, if you scroll a bit further, this is you're going to see a block of code that tells you what happens next. But actually, before I'm going to demonstrate that to you, I want to show you how you can easily locate calls like fopen. What you can do is you can load the program into AutoDebug, and I'll give you a chance to try that later in the course. Once the program is loaded into AutoDebug, you can press Control-N. N stands for names. And this will bring up the names window. And in the names window, you will see references to system calls, because system calls are typically referenced by their name. And we like that, because a name carries a meaning. And you can scroll here, and you can locate a call like fopen, and maybe there are others. You can find the API call that interests you, and then you can press Enter there. And when you do that, AutoDebug will show you another window that shows you all the instances of calls to fopen. And when you press Enter there, it'll take you to that part of the code that you can look at and understand the context within which that call is made. Once you find the API call that you're interested in, that's where you're going to set the breakpoint. In AutoDebug, the way you set a breakpoint is you use the F2 shortcut, or there's also a corresponding menu option. And you set a breakpoint, and you run the program, and you hit the breakpoint, and you may want to confirm that you're on the right path. This is on page 69 in your book. What I have done so far in my analysis is I located this call that I think is going to be a good starting point for my examination. I set a breakpoint there, and then I ran my program within AutoDebug. As soon as it tried to read a file, it paused. Now I can look to see how is it reading my file. You may recall that prior to the call to fopen, there were two push instructions. That pushed the parameters to the stack. That's where the function is going to grab its parameters from. In AutoDebug, the stack is visible to you in the bottom right corner. You're going to see this afternoon. And look at what's on my stack. One of them is the mode, R. I'm opening a file for reading. And the other one is the path to the file that I'm trying to open. It is gust.ini. This confirms that I'm on the right track. Now, something, a question for you. When I looked at this program statically in IDA Pro, all I could see is fopen, some file, and R. Why do you think I did not see the name of the file when I looked at it statically, but when I run the program, I could actually see that name on the stack after all? Yes, so you're correct in that it looks like what it's pushing to the stack is some address where the string is located. And right now, IDA Pro, for whatever reason, was unable to figure out what string resides at that address. That's because some of this information will only be available to you during runtime. So I wanted to mention this to you because sometimes you're going to look at a program statically and you will see fewer details than if you're actually running the program. because some of these strings may be loaded or created during runtime. Statically, this value is not available to us, but when we run it, it does get computed, and we can observe it being used by the program. A lot more details available to you when you actually run the program. So we know we're on the right track. It is opening this file for reading, and now we want to see how does it process it. To answer that question, we'll look at the code. So the code segment that I'm showing you here, as seen through a static disassembler, is almost immediately after the call to fopen. So a little bit above this text box, there's a call to fopen. And after that, there's the block of code that I'm showing you on this slide. What's going on here? How is the program processing the file that it's just opened? As I mentioned earlier, if you're not sure where to begin, look at the call sequence. There's a call to fscanf. Fscanf, nice, we have a name. We can Google that, or Bing it, or whatever. And you will find that fscanf is actually a documented system call that allows you to parse contents of a file. You will also learn that fscanf, as one of its parameters, accepts a format string that tells it how that data that it's reading is supposed to be formatted. And this format string is similar to the regular expression. It specifies that it's reading a line from a file, one line at a time, starting from the beginning all the way to slash n, which is the new line. Because Gustata and I, it was a text file. There was gibberish value in it, but it was one line of gibberish at a time. And it is reading that first line right now. So it opened the file for reading, and now it has read a line from it, from the beginning of the line all the way to its end. That seems to be the purpose of fscanf. And if you were actually stepping through these instructions in OliDebug, you could confirm that indeed it is reading that line from that file. What's happening next? Well, there's another instruction I wanted to introduce to you, and that's a jump instruction. It's at the very bottom of the slide, J and Z. Every instruction whose name begins with J is a jump. There are different kinds of jumps. We're going to go through the different kinds of jumps later in the course, but for now it's enough to say that if it begins with a J, it's a jump. And it's jumping to a memory address. In this case, it's jumping to the location 4036B2. So it opened a file for reading, it read a line from that file, and now it's jumping to this location. What's there? Well, we can go there. Scroll down there, or in IDA Pro, you can just double-click on it, and this is what you will see. So it jumped to location 4036B2, and this is the block of code that is there. What's happening here? Start by looking at the call statements. There's a call to subroutine 405366. We don't know what's there. We don't have its name. We can look at what's there, but let's see if we've got other calls that are easier to understand. There's one at the bottom of the slide. It's a call to a function whose name we do have, scanf. If you research scanf, you'll find that it's one of the ways in which a program can parse contents of a string according to a particular format string. And in this case, the format string is visible on the slide. And this format string specifies that it needs to read from a string. And the string is supposed to be formatted as follows. There's supposed to be some value there, then the equal sign, then more text. So it is parsing a string that's formatted like value equals something else. That's how most INI files are formatted, right? Parameter equals value. What's interesting about Gustata INI is that it did not follow that convention. It was not structured this way. So here's the interesting logic. It read a line from a file, and now it executed the subroutine. And now it's parsing some text as if it was formatted parameter equals value. What seems to be happening here is that something transformed that text. We read gibberish, but here it's expecting to parse that text as if it's formatted this way. Something must have reformatted that text, but where could it have happened? Well, only one choice here. There's a single call to this function. So our method of elimination suggests that this is probably the function that is responsible for transforming the text from gibberish into one that is formatted as parameter equals value. That's the logic here. And you can confirm this logic, if you actually step through these instructions, you will see that that is indeed what's happening. So the working theory is that probably this is the function where decryption or deobfuscation takes place. So you look at that function, and I spent some time looking at that function, and I tell you it wasn't pretty. I actually spent a lot of time, probably too much, trying to figure out the algorithm, and this was hard. And it's not surprising, because sometimes you will find simple algorithms to understand, but in many cases you might find malware using, you know, something like tuple DES or AES, some real-world decryption. Do you really want to spend your time reverse engineering tuple DES? Probably not the wisest use of your time. Yes. So what Cristobal is saying is that, let's say that this function indeed is responsible for decryption. How about we allow the function to execute and look at the return value, right? Because if it does decrypt, then probably it's going to return the decrypted version of the string. And that's exactly the technique that I want to show you. Yeah. Because that's a good one. You can spend a lot of time trying to reverse engineer the algorithm, but what about if you found the function that does the decryption, let it do its magic. And in most cases, it'll return the response that will be the result of the decryption. That's the beauty and the power of being able to do this in a debugger. So what we're going to do is, in OliDebug, set a breakpoint on this specific instruction. And then we're going to run the program in OliDebug. It's going to reach this instruction and then pause. What are we going to see? Well, if you look at the stack, you will see what parameters are passed to this function. Notice that this function accepts two parameters, and statically we don't know what's there. Dynamically, though, when you run it, you can look at the top of the stack, and you will see that these are the two parameters, two cryptic-looking strings. One, the longer string that you see on the slide is actually the first line from gus.ini. This is what it looked like. What about the other string, the shorter one? I did some analysis, and it turns out that this second string, or the first one, depending on where you come from, that's the decryption key. So it looks like it is real decryption taking place here. There needs to be a key. Now, this string that you see here is not visible in clear text anywhere within this executable. This key, there's actually another block of code that grabs characters from various places within the executable, puts them together, then mutates them a little bit, and produces this key. And that's not even the key, because what you don't see here is that the key in the middle of it had a null character. So OliDebug shows you only the first half of the key, because then it sees the null character, it thinks that the string has ended, and doesn't show you anymore. So the actual full key is much longer than what you see here. So I mention this to you because clearly somebody went through a lot of effort to try to conceal that key from us. The thing is, we don't really care, because we now have a way of executing that decryption function and observing the response. So, if you have a function, you don't have to drill into it. You don't have to execute every single instruction of it. You could use a shortcut like Ctrl+F9 to execute that whole function all the way to the end in one step. And then, once the function finishes executing, you can look at the return value. In most cases, the return value will be stored in a register called EAX. And in this case, the return value is an ASCII string, Nick equals Mikey. So a few things happening here. I kind of sneaked in there the discussion about registers without properly talking about registers. And we'll see registers again. The idea behind registers is that they're specialized memory locations that are embedded right into the CPU, and they're highly efficient, very fast. There are very few of them. And we're going to get to know the registers pretty well. The one that we are starting with is the register called EAX. If you're going to know only one register, know EAX, because by default, this is where the functions will typically save their return value. And you're going to see this in OliDebug by just glancing at your screen. And this is the return value, Nick equals Mikey. Well, you're correct, yes. I'm somewhat oversimplifying things. In this case, the register has the value 5109C8. But that turns out to be the address of a string that is Nick equals Mikey. But usually, when you talk about this, to keep things simpler, you just say, oh yeah, the register contains Nick equals Mikey, even though actually it contains a pointer to a memory address that contains that string. So now we have a way of decoding gas theta and I. We still have no idea what algorithm is used to protect it, but maybe we don't care. Because now you just keep doing this for every single line, and you have a way of decrypting the file. And this is a very powerful technique that works in many, many situations, whether it read the file from the internet or from a local file system. So I went through this for every line, and here is what I found out. So this is the decrypted version of the file. I highlighted in yellow those values that we have observed behaviorally, and now we can see why when we place this file onto the infected system, the behavior of the malicious program changes. It looks like it provides a way for the attacker to change the way the program behaves without having to recompile the executable. So the attacker can override the nickname that it uses, can override the channel that it uses, can provide many different IRC servers that it can try connecting to. What's also interesting is that even though we saw the channel MIC-AG with the word soup, there looks like to be another channel that the program supports. I don't know what's the deal with this guy and the word soup, but we see the channel MIC-AG, and there's something called soup channel that's called alpha soup. This is very powerful, because maybe now we have another signature we can use to create, to determine whether we have more systems in the enterprise infected with this thing. So this is the kind of information that you have available to you. In this case, we're fortunate in that not only do we have the right side of this, the actual string values, but we have the additional contextual information that's part of the config file, like the name of the value. So if you saw alpha soup by itself, you might have a hard time figuring out what it's used for, but because you see it's called soup channel, you know, oh, that's probably an IRC channel that the program supports. So when you analyze malware, you also do look for those additional contextual details that can bring meaning to the individual strings and values that you have observed. So this is as much as I want to say about SRVCP.exe. We did not get to talk about the commands that the program supported, although at this point we do suspect that because it's a bot, it probably provides the attacker a way of executing arbitrary commands on the system, so it's a pretty dangerous incident. But my goal, of course, was not to teach you about this particular malware sample, because we really don't care about it. Instead, I wanted to use it as a way to show you a few really useful techniques for how to do behavioral analysis and code analysis. And we're going to build upon these techniques as the course progresses. So we talked about how to set up the lab, and we discussed the general framework and the tools we're going to be using and building upon in the course. And now I want to give you some time to actually set up that lab. At the end of most sections in this course, I'm going to have some hands-on exercises. Some of those exercises we're going to do together as the course and the lecture progresses. In some cases, I'm going to set aside some time to let you work on the exercises on your own. And right now, the exercises are boring because the most important exercise is to actually set up your lab. And if you happen to have some time left over, then take a look at this little malware sample that I gave you called Hanuman. If you don't have time to look at Hanuman, don't worry about it. It's one little thing. It's not important. The most important thing is for you to set up your lab. And in the past experience, I find that it takes, about half an hour to 45 minutes to finish all the setup and to test it. The instructions for what you need to set up is in your books, starting on page 84. I walk you through the instructions of what to copy where and what to install, and you need to use the DVD that I prepared for the course. If you don't have that DVD, just raise your hand, and we're going to get you a copy of it. I asked you to already install VMware. It's commercial software. I don't have the license for it, so you needed to have VMware installed on your system. And I also asked you to create a Windows virtual machine you're going to infect, because unfortunately I don't have the Windows licenses to give you. So that should be already prepared. That's one of the prerequisites for the course. Now you have a Windows virtual machine and the tools that I have on your CD or on your DVD. These are the tools you're going to install into your Windows virtual machine with the one that you're going to be infecting. So the tools you're installing, you're going to install them into your Windows virtual machine that you're going to infect, not onto your physical host. With the one exception of the Linux virtual machine that I gave you, that one is going to be running in parallel with the Windows virtual machine, and this Linux virtual machine that I'm calling Remnux is on your DVD as well. So go through the instructions. please don't just read the slide portion in your books. Look at the notes as well, because they've got some hints and pointers. Here's the goal. The goal is that when we come back from lunch, I need to have your lab set up and tested, because we're going to start with an exercise right away as soon as we come back from lunch. You've got time to do it. You've got time to troubleshoot it. And if you still have time left over, go through the example that I just showed you. Look at Hahnemann. My main thing is get your lab set up and test it. I'm going to be around, of course. If you have any questions, if something doesn't work for you, let me know. So that's what we're going to do until 12:15, and that's going to be our lunch time. If you finish early and you want to take off for lunch early, you're most welcome to do that. Started, or rather, let's continue. At this point, your lab should be set up, and if you install the tools into the Windows Virtual Machine, and if your Windows VM was able to ping your Linux Virtual Machine, then I think you're all set. Those of you who have time, maybe took a quick look at this specimen Hahnemann. I'm going to go over that very quickly, because it's not the most exciting malware in the world. But this Hahnemann executable, if you ran it on your Windows Virtual Machine, you would really notice that it begins listening on port 3333. If you infected your system with this process, Hahnemann, Process Explorer would show you the malicious process. You would just need to select properties, and it would say it's listening on port 3333. Now, I thought I'd throw in this example here just to remind you that sometimes malware will not initiate an outbound connection. In this case, it's just sitting there listening. And you know, if it's listening, then you connect to it and you see what happens. And in this case, if you connected to it, you would just, I have a screenshot right here. You would get a shell. So you connect to it and it's as if you're logged in. No authentication required. So it opens a back door, the attacker telnets to that port number, and they're in. That's all that this executable does. If you looked at its strings, you would notice that there's a URL. This is where the website resided that distributed this executable. But that's really all there's to it. Not the most interesting executable in the world. But some of you had a chance to look at it, perhaps, because we had just a little bit of time before the lunch break.